Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest is John Cozy. Always good to have John back. That sure is a very lively hour's discussion. Never a shortage of topics, and I always like to talk about, among other things, John's latest writing. A couple of weeks ago, he sent me an article that I quoted from because it's a topic I revisit all the time. I call it Money Power. And John discussed how the influence of money in the country and so on. His title was "How the Economy Works." Well, you know, it's an economy that needs fraud to survive. Well, you know, finance, Wall Street, the rest of it. My God, I've written plenty about that. I revisit that topic all the time, John. Too bad we can't get in on that gravy train. But the other one, I'll just mention your other one, John. I'll let you jump in. You sent me an article today. You've written about this before. It's been a while since I've written about SCOTUS. Everybody know who SCOTUS is? Supreme Court of the United States. I love these names. Acronyms. Anyway, John has taken another justifiable whack at our highest court in the land. John, I think the whack they get is they deserve it the most because they're the highest court. But all the others deserve whacks on the order on the pecking order on which they reside. Especially the federal courts, the state courts are no gems, but the federal ones are the worst. And the Federalist Society, with the lowest of the low, sending their members to the various courts in the land, so they can screw ordinary people and take care of the rich and wealthy and the rich and powerful and so on. John, welcome. I could keep this thing up for the whole hour.
Keep going, Steve.
You want to talk about money power first, then we'll jump over to SCOTUS?
Yeah. That article was motivated by a simple measure that everybody thinks is very important in America, and that is gross domestic product.
Gross domestic deception, John.
Yeah, I mean, that you know, what people don't, hardly anyone knows what gross domestic product is. And not only do they not know what it is, a lot of people equate it with the economy. If gross domestic product goes up, they'll say the economy is growing. No, it's not. It's just a number that's getting bigger. You know, or if gross domestic product falls, they'll say the economy is tanking. No, the economy's got nothing to do with gross domestic product. Gross domestic product is a simple measure of how much money goes from the pockets of consumers to the pockets of vendors. That's all it is. It's nothing more than that. And one of the things I wanted to point out is that a lot of bad stuff gets counted as product in that number. I gave some examples. I said, suppose, I don't know, a fire breaks out in some person's building and it does enough damage to cause the owner of the building to take down the building and carry off its and have its rubbish carried off. Okay, that's a building has been destroyed, and every cent paid to the people who took that building down and carted off the junk is domestic product. Now, so here you have something being destroyed that's counted as product. Okay, I mean, that's absurd. And it gets dumber. The article, well, I wrote that article 2 weeks ago, Steve. I don't remember it all.
Oh, John, I really have a problem with my articles because I write so many of them. I have a hard time associating titles with content. And once in a while, I'll get an email from somebody, and they'll say, I really loved your article.
Which one?
Yeah. I have no idea which one they're talking about.
Yeah, that happens to me. But anyhow, I ended up saying, look, you know, death in America is even a product. When somebody dies in America, a whole bunch of people get hired to do stuff. And every cent spent to hire those people to do stuff, from the undertaker to the guy who digs the grave in the graveyard. You know, that's all domestic product. So, you know, I ended the piece saying, look, you want to make, you know, the economy look good? Simply, here's the moral. Go out and kill a lot of people, folks. Every cent spent on their funerals and stuff is domestic product. Economists will love it.
You know, even better than that, go out and blow up one town, city after another.
Well, yeah, and somewhere in the piece, I pointed out that, you know, the people who took down 9/11, and I don't want to get into a debate over who took down the buildings at 9/11, okay? But whoever took down 9/11 weren't terrorists. They were entrepreneurs. Look at all the money being spent to take away that junk and to build new buildings. They're okay. Job creators, guys. These guys who took down the World Trade Center and Building 3, whatever it was, you know, these are job-creating entrepreneurs. They're not terrorists.
John, it's so true. The more destruction that happens, the greater the lift to GDP.
Yeah, you know, and that's just how absurd, you know, the American economy has gotten. You know, destruction and death are products.
Absolutely, yeah. John. By your definition of GDP, anybody can go to a website called Shadow Stats. I don't subscribe, so I don't get all the detail behind it. But an economist by the name of John Williams runs the service. He charges a fee for it, but he puts some headline data on his website. He's got GDP at minus 2% right now. He's got unemployment at, I believe it's 22.9%. I could check it. I think that was his last number, and it took a big jump from last month. And he's got minus GDP numbers since roughly 2006. Solid minus GDP numbers. 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and half of 12, all in the minus column. Nothing in the plus column.
Sure. I don't have any doubt about that. But, you know, that's interesting that he should charge for that money, you know. I mean, for that information, because every cent paid to him is DP.
Well, I mean, he's got to eat. He's got to pay the rent. So
so do I. But I charge for my articles, and so do you. And you don't charge for yours.
Oh yeah. Well, I had one working lifetime, John, and I guess true for you as well. And at this stage, I just do it because I want to do it, because it's important to do it.
Yeah,
and you do it for
and
the same reason.
And you know, I wonder why he doesn't do it just because he wants to do it.
Well,
this business of I have to earn a living. Yeah, you do, but you don't have to earn a living selling information that belongs to everybody, that everybody ought to have.
Well, I would love to have the detail behind his information. I've requested it from him, saying that I would love to quote him, and my articles get some pretty good distribution. It would be some good promotion for him, and he never seemed willing to do it, but a regular on this program, John, sadly, he passed away. He was about a year or two my junior. Bob Chapman, he puts out a wonderful newsletter. He did, the International Forecaster. It still comes out. Others are carrying on in his place. But he would come on, and just like you do, John, and he put just the kind of stuff in his newsletter you don't see anyplace else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people can do this stuff. I just get so upset with Americans, you know. We have these think tanks that are pure propaganda mills, okay? People get paid to put out this propaganda, and they get a tax break for it. Yeah, I mean, this country's absurd. But aside from that, I just want to get back to my article. I mean, and that is that if people really understood what the economists count as domestic product, they would laugh. I mean, you know, everybody thinks, gee, GDP is going up. That's good. It's not necessarily good. GDP can go up while people are dying and starving and being dispossessed from their homes. And that's what the economists hide, and they don't tell people because they don't. They make GDP sound like some important kind of figure. It ain't. It's just a calculation of how much money flows upward.
John, I highlight what you just said in one article after another. I write only occasionally on the economy and the financial side of the economy, banking and so on, but I highlight all the time that we have a bifurcated system. For ordinary people, we literally are going through a protracted depression, and I always put a capital D on that. I don't want anybody to think I'm talking about somebody who's depressed. I'm talking about an economic situation that is a depression. For ordinary people living in poverty, losing their homes, struggling to pay the bills, pay the rent, get medical care if they need it. I mean, these people are really going through some really, really hard times, and they don't get much play in the media.
Yeah, I've said, I don't know whether I've said it on this program or not, but I've said on some other programs I've been on, that this downturn in the economy is worse than the Great Depression for many, many, many people. It is.
It's worse, John, because back then, there was stimulus done to create jobs. Roosevelt created millions of jobs. He didn't get the country out of the Great Depression until World War II, but he created millions of jobs, and there's virtually nothing done to create jobs now. And the ones that are created are rotten ones. They're temporary ones. They're part-time ones. They have poor benefits, if any benefits at all. You know, the Walmart jobs, the McDonald's jobs, the jobs that most people would never take unless they simply don't have a choice and they need to bring in income by doing something, so they'll scrub floors or clean toilets just to be able to feed their family.
But this downturn is worse for other reasons too. What you said is true. My brother, I wasn't old enough to, but my brother worked in the Civilian Conservation Corps, which did an awful lot of good in America.
Oh, it sure did.
This downturn is worse because there were no banks, big banks like there are today. The banks were local. And all the houses that people in the community held, that the banks held mortgages on, didn't get thrown out of their houses. The bankers would have been hung if they tried that. And furthermore, they didn't want the houses vacant. You know, they left people live in their houses.
John, on top of that, Roosevelt had a program. I'm trying to think of the exact name. It was something like the Homeowners Refinancing Program. It literally was a program to help homeowners who were going to lose their homes be able to refinance at lower rates and get government help to be able to stay in their homes. The policy of the administration in the 1930s was to keep people from losing their homes.
Yeah.
And the policy today is screw them.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this you know, I say it all the time. Since the end of the Second World War, probably starting in the 1970s, in late 1960s, this country has become mean, really mean. You know, I mean, they will take a banker will take his mother's head, you know, if he could sell it for a dollar. That is how mean this country has become.
Yeah, it really has, John. It really has, and it's very sad, you know, and very disturbing, because so many millions of people are being harmed so much, and it's going to get worse at the end of the year. January 1st, there are automatic cuts scheduled to kick in.
A couple of trillion dollars.
I mean, literally, when people need help, they're going to slam them on the back of the head and hit them harder. That literally is agreed bipartisan policy. Doesn't matter who wins the election, who wins the Congress. That is already a cut deal.
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, you know, but that's what's happened to America, and it's all the fault of American economists and the principles that they have pushed. Money trumps everything in this economy, and that was the point of that article we were just discussing. You know, a person's life is nothing. It doesn't count if he lives or dies. What counts is the money spent on his death. You know, I mean, that's how idiotic it has become. You know, and if he dies in a hospital, boy, that's a big boost to domestic product.
Boy, it sure is.
So,
providing he could pay the bill, John.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's so absurd that it's almost difficult to even describe to people in a way that they believe it. I mean, you know, I talk to relatives and stuff about this, and they look at me with glazed eyes. What, I mean, what are you talking about? You know, they don't understand. I mean, they hear this statistic every month about GDP, you know. And, oh, boy, you know, that must mean something. Everybody talks about GDP and its product, what we're producing. We're not producing squat.
That's so true. And they complain about things that are going on. But if you ask them, you know, what is it that's bothering you so much? Don't give them multiple choice. Ask them what's bothering them. So Congress has, I believe, the lowest approval rating in its history, which I think is significant, 10%. My God. The disconnect is that Obama has an approval rating hovering around 50%. It drops a little below at times. I haven't checked it recently, but it's roughly around the 50% mark. How can Obama be rated 50%? And, of course, a lot of the negatives are just built-in racists that would be negative for any black guy, no matter what he did. But 10% for Congress and 50% for Obama, that doesn't compute in my mind. The two of them go together like ham and eggs.
And I quoted, you know, 44% for the Supreme Court. I mean, which is nothing to brag about.
Oh, that's right. And we'll get to the Supreme Court, and boy, my goodness.
I pointed out in an article somewhere recently that if legitimate governments are the governments that govern with the support of their people, the United States government isn't legitimate and has been for a long time.
Boy, it sure isn't. And the Declaration of Independence that I've quoted from, it's been a while. You know, if the government lets the people down, it's the responsibility, the obligation of the people to change the government and get one that does serve the people the way it should. I mean, that literally is in the Declaration of Independence. And I guess Jefferson was the main author. I think others contributed to it. And how the language has been manipulated, I don't know. But what is written, anybody can pull it up on a website and read the Declaration of Independence. There's no ambiguity in the language. If the government doesn't do its job, then get rid of them and get another one.
Yeah, unfortunately, when they wrote the Constitution, they defined treason as armed insurrection against the government. So you can be treasonous so long as you don't carry a gun. You know, which is what the legal community in this country has done.
Well, it sure has, and they can call anything they want to call it. So they can go after people like Bradley Manning and Julian Assange and reporters whose names most people never heard of, and charge them with espionage under the 1917 Espionage Act. I drafted a second article on Assange after Ecuador granted him asylum, John. I wanted to equate asylum with refugee status. I also wanted to say more about the law. I quoted a lot from the law, the Treaty of Vienna. Was it 1951? Oh, I forget the date. Anyway, Treaty of Vienna. I think 1951. Have to check that date. Hope it is in 1851. But Treaty of Vienna that has very, very clear rules on this related to the national sovereignty, the ability of a country like the UK to storm an embassy of another territory that is sovereign territory and so on. Well, it cannot. It's breaking international law, and Britain claims it has a law that enables it to do it, but that's nonsense. But,
Steve, law is a flawed concept. That's why in the articles that I write about it, I write, instead of law, I write flaw. You know, the law is an idiotic thing. I mean, nobody ever responds to law until a law has been broken.
And then it depends on who breaks the law.
Yes, and then it depends upon who breaks the law. You know, the law doesn't create anything. If people obey the law, it's because they choose to for one reason or another. It's not because there's a law. You know, and what are you going to do if Britain, you know, sends commandos or something into the Ecuadorian embassy? Ecuador can do a lot of things, but you know what, you got to bring that up in some court somewhere and take 20 years to adjudicate it, and when it's adjudicated, nobody will even know what the case is all about. I mean, it's a big joke.
It sure is a big joke, and I mean, little Ecuador wouldn't be able to do very much against a big, rough, tough bully of Britain.
Well, yeah, I think they could. I think they could confiscate the passports of every British person in Ecuador and make them stay in Ecuador until it's resolved.
Well, Argentina some years ago tried to reclaim a land that is rightfully theirs, and Margaret in the 1980s, Margaret Thatcher sent the British Navy and killed about a thousand Argentines.
They sunk a ship. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, it was a nasty piece of business, and that was simply a political act on the part of Maggie Thatcher to get her approval rating up.
You can't, I mean, Ecuador is in a place that makes that harder to do. I mean, you know, the Falkland Islands was easy to get to by ship.
Oh, it sure was. I mean, Ecuador, do they have a coastline? I'm not sure. I think they do.
Yeah, they have a coastline, but it's not, I mean, it's, you know. Opposing a landing of British Marines on the Ecuador coast would be a lot easier than, you know, what the British had to deal with in the Falkland Islands.
Oh, that would be much tougher. I don't think Britain wants to send the Marines and make a beach landing into Ecuador. Again, no. I mean they sent the Navy. I don't know if they said, did they send Marines onto the Falklands?
Oh,
or was,
sure.
Was it just a naval battle?
No, they sent Marines on.
They sent Marines in. But again, I mean, you get an island. It's isolated from the mainland, and it's a lot easier to handle that than it is to invade a country.
Well, yeah. But so you know, I mean, I'm saying that Ecuador could do things like just confiscate all those passports so that people could continue to live and do what they wanted to do in Ecuador, but they couldn't go anywhere else. I mean, you know, that would be a nasty little thing for Ecuador to do. I mean, yeah, there are lots of things you can do.
Oh, they sure could if they want. I don't think either country wants to get into a real, real row with the other one.
No, I don't think so either. But, you know, I think a former British a diplomat said so today, said that the Foreign Office had overplayed its hand. Yeah, I sure did.
Oh, it really did overplay its hand, and I think Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa, he obviously had some ulterior motives why he wanted to do this. He wanted to look good with the home crowd to get his approval rating up and so on. He hasn't done as much as people hoped he would do for the Ecuadorian people, so he wanted to boost his ratings. That was one reason. But once he gave Assange asylum in the London embassy, I think if he threw him out, that would have just crashed his rating. It was possible he could have thrown him to the wolves. I think he had no choice but to grant him asylum. Now the problem is, how the hell do you get him out of the country? And I wrote about that today. The London Guardian had an article on it, and I used material from the article citing them in the last part of a very long article I wrote on Assange today, the second one, and I'll put the article out tomorrow. It's Julian Assange, political refugee. He is a political refugee, and he's also not true blue, but that's another issue. But he certainly deserves better than he's getting. And Sweden is just Sweden is a way station. and Britain is running cover for Washington, and the idea is to get him back to America. The New York Times had a story that there's already an indictment out, a sealed indictment. They want to get him into court. They want to put him into prison, and they're going to charge him with violations of the 1917 Espionage Act that had everything to do with World War One and real espionage, you know, the stuff that goes on in wars, and nothing to do with going after whistleblowers.
But well, somebody asked me the other day, you know, whether or not America is going to become a right-wing dictatorship. And I said, it already has. I mean, you know, it's been that way for a while now. I mean, yeah, all the trappings of democracy are there, and that's why I wrote that other article, you know, the one I sent you yesterday. I mean, you know, the Supreme Court now has taken control of elections. When it interfered in the election of 2000, it showed that, you know, it can take over any election it wants at any time. It has now decided, you know, who can contribute, who can corrupt the government. It's made corruption of the government a constitutional right for the affluent.
Or in other words, John, the law is what the court says the law is.
Yeah, which is a joke.
Which is really a joke. I mean, all the statutes, the Constitution, all of them are what the Supreme Court says it is. And one court can say one thing, another court can say something else, a third one can be in between the other two. I mean, what kind of a system is that? The law should be the law is the law. It shouldn't be what A says, what B says. Well, let's compromise. We'll meet in the middle. That's not what the law is. And of course,
it's not even a compromise anymore.
It's not even a compromise. That's right. Really, the destruction of the law. We need to take a break. I guess the undoing of America at least began in 1803, John. Marbury versus Madison. Oh, John Marshall, he's the boss.
Yep.
He's the boss. Anyway, we'll take a quick break, John, and come back. We'll talk about Marbury. We'll talk about SCOTUS and all the rest of it. We'll be right back. On with John Cozy, talking about the economy, the money power in the country. We'll talk about SCOTUS now and how they do whatever. You know, the
I got something I want to interject here. I was just looking at the headlines here while we're listening to your music and stuff, and I just read that Donald Trump is really in deep trouble now.
Oh, what? Tell me. I have no idea what's going on.
A Chinese girl was just named Miss World.
And that gets Donald Trump in trouble?
Well, Donald Trump holds Miss World contest, and he's against
China. Oh, did he really? Oh, I had no idea. I don't keep up on that stuff.
I wonder what he's going to do now.
Well, I get breaking New York Times headlines. The event happens, and they were a little bit slow on the switch, but they catch up. And there was nothing in my in-basket about my inbox about breaking news. I thought you're gonna lay a blockbuster on me and my listeners, John. Well, poor Don. He runs the Miss World contest.
Yep.
He makes a buck out of that, too?
I think so.
I can't imagine he would do anything if he couldn't make a buck out of it, a lot of bucks out of it.
Yeah. Well, to get back to SCOTUS, the reason I wrote that article, there were two reasons I wrote that article. I wanted to point out how the court has taken over the country. I mean, that But I've made that point before. Okay, so there's nothing new about that, and I didn't have to write an article to make that point again. But conflict in America has gotten bad, really bad. Are you there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And one of the reasons for it, I contend, is the court's politically biased decisions. Ordinarily, one would expect the court to try to resolve issues. But the American court does not, courts in America do not resolve issues. They issue politically biased opinions that merely exacerbate conflict, the issues in the conflicts. And it gets to the point where there is no way at all to solve these conflicts once the court has created them. I mean, they turn legal problems into social problems. There's no way to solve, you know, the dispute between abortionists and anti-abortionists in this country. No way. Even, you know, yeah, it, and some people have. They turn to violence. Okay, but that just gets them deeper in trouble. I mean, there's no way to solve the conflict. There's nowhere that Americans can go to get, you know, some sort of rational discussion going about this issue so that you can solve the problem. The same thing is true of numerous other issues. The Citizens United issue, you know, there's no way to solve that problem except perhaps a constitutional amendment, but I'm not even sure that would solve the problem. The court has set up the country for a conflict, for internal conflict that's irresolvable. And it's completely the court's fault, and some previous justices of the court have warned the court about it. Yeah, so you have this sort of situation going where the institution, well, this institution, which Madison thought was the bulwark, you know, guaranteeing liberty in America, has in fact become the destroyer of all of the Enlightenment values that our founding fathers, if they all didn't hold them, at least many Enlightenment values were held by the founding fathers. And I don't know how, you know, what I wrote there. I wrote that the court has turned this incipient Enlightenment nation into an endarkened reactionary one. And that's exactly what has happened. And there's no way to fix it. There's no way to fix it because there's no way to put a limit on the court's power. We've gotten ourselves into a really bad mess.
I think the system overall, John, is so broken, so dysfunctional, so corrupt, so destructive, that there is no possible way to fix this thing. It's so deep-seated. It's a cancer that's crossed the Rubicon, and you can't bring it back. And my only solution is we literally have to start over. We need to scrap the entire business that we have, but we need to start over again from scratch. Usually that's pretty radical stuff. It often means having a revolution, and a revolution usually means violence, and most revolutions don't turn out so well.
That's right. That's right. That's the difficulty.
The ones that most people could think of, the French Revolution didn't turn out well. The Russian Revolution didn't turn out well. All empires don't turn out well. So how on earth do you have a revolution and do it nonviolently and make it turn out well? Well, if I had a formula to lay out in detail, I sure would do it. I don't know. I don't know that anybody knows. I guess it's just a crapshoot if people really want to go for broke and literally get rid of what they have and go for something else. It's a crapshoot on what they're going to get, and they may end up with something worse than what they have. It's an awfully, awfully terrible situation. At the same time, what we have now is getting worse and worse and worse. And I don't know how much pain people can take, but I've said a few times in articles that there's some point where you cross a threshold of no return, and then it's Katie by the door and anything can happen. And there are people a lot smarter and been around a lot longer thinking about these things than I have, and they see some mighty, mighty disruptive times ahead, and I have a feeling that they're right. It could be very, very mean and nasty for an awful lot of people.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and I think that, well, I hate that word. I suspect that that's true. I don't have, any way to...
it's tough predicting the future, John.
I don't have any way to come up with, evidence to support that view, but it seems to me that the only way that things are going to change is an utter global economic and political collapse. If globalization explodes into pieces so that countries don't have anything to do with each other, and if internally economies collapse so that internally people, have to build a new system from scratch, that might be the only thing to do. And like everything else, like global warming, people are beginning to realize now that, it's happening. Yeah, okay. They didn't expect it to happen like it is. They didn't expect it to happen, overnight. But, that's one of the things that some mathematical systems that people have worked on have known, that a change can take a long time to develop, but when it does, then it happens. Like breaking an egg, it happens all at once. Bingo, the whole thing collapses. I suspect that that's what will happen to civilization, or what we call civilization, on this earth. And because the problems that Americans face are being faced everywhere. They're being faced in Europe. They're being faced in the Middle East. They're being faced in Africa. And, look at India. What a pathetic country that is. One of these days, politics as we know it, governments as we know them, will simply be destroyed. They have to be.
Yeah, I think it's true, John. Things, because the world is a lot smaller now than it was many years ago, and what affects the wealthiest nations, goes down, and it affects the less wealthy nations. Well, India and China are the two biggest countries population-wise, and they have many millions of people who do just fine for themselves. But the great masses of people face very, very deep poverty. I had a good friend. Sadly, she took ill. She passed away much too young. But she decided she wanted to go to India to try to feed hungry people who would starve to death without any kind of help, providing them minimal amounts of food to survive. And it's incredible what a small amount of U.S. dollars can do to feed people and just keep them alive, not make their lives wonderful, but just keep them alive. And she left a comfortable U.S. surrounding, went to India. And I don't know what happened there, but she took ill, and she passed away, and I didn't know it, and I wondered why I hadn't heard from her in some time. Well, the reason was that she was deathly ill, and she ended up leaving India, going to a hospice in Germany. And a few months ago, she passed away, and I wrote about her. Terrible suffering in that country. China, my God, for all the growth China has and India has, the poverty in those countries is just staggering. The poverty exceeds the population of America easily.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
deep poverty, John. Deep poverty.
Yeah,
poverty,
I know. I mean,
deep poverty.
Every day in India, a large number of primitive farmers commit suicide because they can't. Yeah, I mean, and you know, nobody says anything about the companies outsourcing jobs to India. Don't say anything about that or don't care about it. You know, and the Indian politicians are, you know, even worse than ours, and that's something. But you know, the whole world is faced with this situation, and it's all because of an idiotic economic practices that Western Europe has foisted on the whole world. And you know, it's interesting that Mitt Romney, you know, will have his $250 million in a bank account in somewhere, okay? And that's paper money. And if the American dollar, if America collapses and the American dollar goes with it, so does Mitt's fortune.
You know, I'm sure he's got his assets spread around a little bit. And my suspicion on why he doesn't want to release his income taxes is he makes an enormous amount of money. I know he's probably wants to come across as a man of the people. Isn't that what all presidential candidates want to do?
Yeah,
well, Obama's a millionaire. Romney is a lot richer than Obama is. His association with Bain Capital, when I wrote about him, I put a number in my article that he was getting somewhere on the order just by being on the outside, and I don't know what he does for Bain Capital, but he's doing something. I guess that would be severed if he becomes president, but he gets something on the order of $20 million a year in income from Bain Capital, even though he is now in the U.S. government and he's a presidential candidate. I mean, he's picking up a monthly paycheck that approaches a couple of $1 million a month. He doesn't want people to know that.
Yeah, I know. You know, yeah, of course he doesn't want people to know that. But my point is that you know, currencies nowadays are just paper. But once upon a time, you know, you held piles of gold somewhere or something or other. But you know, nobody does that anymore. It's all paper money or notations on a spreadsheet, you know. And if the world economy collapses, all that paper money and all those spreadsheet notations are useless, worthless.
Well, of course, if that's going to happen, John, these people get inside information. You know it's going to happen next month or the month after. So they pull their money out of what they feel is unsafe. They send it off to what they think is safe. They also have countless trillions of dollars stashed away in tax havens. A lot of them are just virtual havens. They can be anywhere. This is online stuff. I don't know anything about the people that the big major banks and other players run this money. I wrote an article on it. My goodness, I wrote it over a week ago. I still haven't gotten it out because other things are time sensitive, and I want to get those out. But there are many, many trillions of dollars stashed in physical tax havens.
Yeah, that's true. But once upon a time, wealth was physical wealth. Now it's not. It's just virtual wealth. You know, and you know, so you have a $250 million worth of currency somewhere or other, stashed here or there or wherever. What good is it if nobody wants it?
Well, that's so true, and I guess gold has real worth. But even gold, I guess gold is only worth the value that people want to place on it.
That's right.
If people called it fool's gold, then it wouldn't be worth anything.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I mean, I tell you a story. I was at a dinner party a week or so ago, and I said, you know, human beings are weird. And everybody looked up at me, well, what's this all about? And I said, you know, we'll go to a grocery store, and we'll complain about the price of milk. But we'll go to a jewelry store and spend thousands of dollars on rocks. And there you have it. I mean, that's how dumb human beings are.
Yeah. It really is true. I mean, you buy something someone calls a precious gem. Well, how do you determine that it is a precious gem?
Exactly.
I mean, what if somebody sold you, literally something that was worth far, far less than they claim it is. How would any ordinary people know other than what they're told?
Yeah, right. I mean, but still, you know, I mean, what do you do with rocks?
What do you do with rocks? That's right.
You know, I mean, and yet, you know, that's the kind of stuff that human beings value. And you know, it's true of the Romneys and you know, other people, the diamonds and you know, all those billionaires, you know. I mean, what do they you know, what do? They don't have food stashed away. They couldn't do that, you know. They don't even have they may have some interest in commodities. They may own some stocks in commodities or whatever, but they don't have commodities in their basements that they can rely on, you know. And if the world goes to hell, what are they going to do? I don't know. I wonder if they know what they're going to do.
I don't know what they'll do either, John. And for most of my life, my adult life, I always valued living simply. And now here I am in my retirement, and I never really craved stuff, the stuff that most people crave. And usually when they get it, it's you know, it's something they're delighted to have around for a while, and then they get tired of it, and an automobile or a home, something big, you know, something they would buy and they can carry home themselves, it ends up in a closet or in a corner, and they just go after the next thing that attracts them. And the things that I valued most, and I certainly do now at this stage in my life, the things that you can't put a price on. So the things that I do, John, that you're doing, and when you get people who read what we both write, or listen to this program, and they appreciate what they're hearing, and they appreciate what they're reading, and they thank you for what you're doing, you can't put a price tag on that, and that's what means the most to me, and to be doing things that we hope can help other people, and to be thanked for what we do, and to have followers around the world who pay attention to us, and maybe we can help them in a very small way. I just think that's marvelous. I cannot go to the mall and plunk down any amount of money and buy the equivalent of what I can get for nothing based on what I'm doing.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, you don't know this, and maybe I shouldn't put it, I shouldn't say it on the air.
Oh, go ahead.
But I'm homebound for more than a decade now. I have slowly been going blind.
Oh, and, that I didn't know, John.
And you know, I don't even know how much longer I'm going to be able to continue writing. And I can still read if it's on my computer monitor, but I can't read a book anymore. I can't read a newspaper anymore. I can't do any of those things. Okay, so I'm homebound. I can't go anywhere, and yet I have everything I need. I don't have to go out and get stuff. Okay, and I'm sort of like you. You know, I don't need much. I don't want much.
John, in my case, I have a bum knee. I had a few surgeries that didn't really do the job, and I'm not immobile. I'm not in a wheelchair. I'm not unable to get around and do stuff, but I simply can't do what I once could do. I used to love to run at one time. Then when my knees started going bad, I began walking instead of running. I can still walk, but I can't walk the way I used to, and I can't stand for long periods of time. But I say to myself, John, that the people that I write about who really have grave problems around the world, me and my bum knee, you know, I'm in my apartment, and so far at least they're not breaking down the door to haul me away. Maybe they will at some point. But I write about people who really have grave problems that I don't know how they deal with them every day. They literally don't know where the next meal is coming from. They're brutalized, I mean really brutalized, by the governments they have, the people in Egypt, the people in Palestine, in Bahrain, other parts of the world. I'm not going through that. So I feel very grateful for the things I have, rather than the things I've lost. We all lose things over time. The body is just another machine. Over time, it breaks down one way or another. Nobody gets off the hook. Nobody
That's right.
literally gets off. So you told me about your bad back, and I think a bad back is a lot worse than a bad knee. I remember one day only I had a backache. It went away, but I could not find a comfortable position. Even lying down on a hard, flat surface, I could not get comfortable, and I'll never forget the feeling I had that if I had to put up with this every day, that would make life very, very hard, and you're talking about slowly going blind. I have cataracts that make my vision slightly impaired. So far, I can function. And my doctor told me, as long as I can do it and do what I'm doing, fine, just keep going the way you are. But my vision's a little bit clouded, and I do the best I can. And if I reach the point where I can't function, well, I'll get them off. I don't relish the thought of having surgery for anything. But again, you know, we get older, John, as we both know, and things just don't function the way they used to. Young people will discover that one day. And my advice to young people, John, is... stay young.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the answer.
Boy, that's the answer. If we could only do it. If we could only do it. We've got about 3 minutes left, John. I want to give it all to you. We didn't get into SCOTUS very much, except to say, you know, the law is what they say it is. But any final comments that you want to make before the hour's over?
My point in writing the SCOTUS article, you know, was not merely to show how the court has taken over the government. I mean, like I said, I've written that article 2 or 3 times, so that's not new. But what I wanted to show was the court, by issuing biased political decisions, no matter whether the court is liberal at the time or conservative at the time, ends up causing conflict in society that then becomes irresolvable. When a conservative court does, you know, what the court did in 2000 when it interfered in the election, it lost the respect of all of Al Gore's voters. If they had issued a decision that went the other way, if they had gone for Gore instead of Bush, it would have ended up losing the respect of all the people who voted for Bush. And a court that has no respect is a court that has no authority. And the violence and meanness that has occurred in America over the last half century and continues to grow is, I suspect, very much caused by the way the court has operated, becoming, a bunch of bigots issuing bigoted decisions. And I ended up I ended that article. If anybody wants to go look and read it, it's on Global Research and it'll be on my website tomorrow. About the Dred Scott decision, it caused the war, destroyed a culture, destroyed hundreds of thousands of people, and physically, and it even destroyed the Chief Justice who wrote the decision. He ended up despised by everyone, Southerners and Northerners, and in poverty. And that's the kind of thing a bad court can bring upon the world. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised that the court will do that same sort of thing to America in the near future.
Oh, I think you're right, John, and I wish we had more time, but we are out of it. Again, my great thanks. I look forward to having you back next month. Never run out of these important things to discuss, things that everybody needs to know. That's what this program is dedicated to, and to having wonderful guests come on like you, John. Again, my great thanks.
Oh, you're welcome, Steve. Take care.
Thanks, John. And join us every Thursday, of course, 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. John McMurtry will be here tomorrow. Make it a regular habit.